Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you, Jeffrey. Good to be back at FEE and to see so many faces interested in the subject of liberty. And we're going to be talking about entrepreneurs and a little bit about my book, The Myth of the Robber Barons. But thinking about this and entrepreneurs and the rise of the United States, because we were a second-rate power for a long time in the 1800s. And then in the late 1800s, we began to emerge as a major world power. It's interesting to think about the Constitution and the way we started. How many knew that it? We had a deficit after the American Revolution. We had a war debt, right? How many know we paid the whole thing off and we're running budget surpluses within a generation or so of the founders? Yeah, we're running budget surpluses. In other words, the taxes, because we didn't have an income tax, we had a protective tariff. And we had land sales, we were raising revenue with that, and whiskey tax. So, I mean, if the revenue is here, say up at here, the expenses are here. And we don't even have an income tax. And the revenue's up here, and the expenses are here. And we pay off the debt completely, and are running surpluses. And then, under President Andrew Jackson, that's an issue. What are we going to do with this money that is in excess of what we're spending? Now, if that isn't exciting to get things going, I don't know what is. Yeah. What a time in American history. And President Jackson even had this speech where he was saying, well, here's what I think we ought to do with this surplus. Because some people were saying, well, we could reduce the tariffs and just get rid of the whiskey tax and all that. And he said, yeah, that's possible, but in case we have another war, as we did, of course, with the Mexican War, it might be good to have those taxes in place. And then he was suggesting giving the surplus back to the states. After all, we are a federation of states. Give the surplus back to the states. And so the idea was then it was, well, should every state get the same amount or should big states get more? And we thought, yeah, we're going to do it by population. So the bigger your population, the more you got. Well, then you get this whole issue, because I teach at Hillsdale College in Michigan. And the issue then becomes at Hillsdale College, or rather in the state of Michigan, it becomes, we are a territory. See, Ohio got in the Union, and Michigan was squabbling with Ohio over the border. Michigan wanted Toledo. And Ohio wouldn't let Michigan have Toledo. And so Michigan thought, well, we're just not going to join the Union then. We're just going to be a territory. But then all of this business of money is coming in if you're a state. And then it was also going to be how big you were, but it was also, were you in the Union the whole year? And if you were only in the Union half a year, you only got half as much money of the surplus. So Michigan had a meeting in 1837... and voted, we want to become a state, we want to become a state now, and that's why Michigan became a state in January. So they could get the whole share of the surplus for 1837. Yeah, that's why they call it the good old days, I guess. We were adhering to the Constitution. You say, for example, some people thought it would be good to establish a national university that would kind of blend all the people from the North and South, and it would become a major institution. And this got a lot of sentiment. And then we looked in the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, and there was no role for the federal government in education. So they thought, well, we won't do it. Right around here, the Hudson River, it comes up close to where we really get going with the Erie Canal. It becomes part of the Erie Canal, the chain. That was a very profitable canal. The state of New York said, well, why shouldn't we have the government do it? It's profitable. And the federal government, in effect, the congressman said, because it's not in the Constitution that the federal government should be allocating money for internal improvements. It's the state's job to do that. So the reason the Erie Canal was eventually built, it was the state of New York raised the money within the state. It was not considered a federal task. See, the founders realized if it's a federal task, then the people with the most political clout will get in and use that to their advantage, and smaller states won't have as much opportunity. If you want your state to have canals and rivers and good sources of transportation, roads and that sort of thing, build them yourself. Or have private enterprise build it. That happened too. Yeah, that was the attitude. And that's why the debt is very small. And that's why we are on our way in the 1830s. Now, this gets interesting because you don't run a surplus for very long before you have politicians who say, you know what, I have an idea for what to do with that surplus. And that's exactly what we had in the 1840s. We're running surpluses, and we're politicians are saying, well, maybe we need a national university, internal improvements. We vote those off. And then a man named Edward Collins came to Congress with an idea. Edward Collins. Collins' idea. He said, look, what we need with this money is to give a federal subsidy to a steamship company. I looked around and you think, well, that's, yeah, really, you know, not, right? Well, but he said, no, wait, hear me out. Steamships were transforming American life, and it actually made sense in the context of the 1840s. If you look at, in the same way that the computer and the internet has done in the late 1900s and early 2000s, it really brings, it shrinks the world, it brings groups into closer contact with one another. When Columbus discovered America, it took him he did several voyages. It took him 2 to 3 months to come over here. And then it took him about 2 to 3 months coming back, depending on wind currents. He might be able to do it in 2 months, 60 days, 62 days in that area, or he could do it more like 80 to 90 days. Now, think about this. That was unchanged by the early 1800s, the technology. It was still wind. But when we get steam technology, we can use coal and engines to propel a steamship through the water against the current. It creates a tremendous burst of speed that was unknown before. And it makes you less dependent on natural forces and more easily able to operate at man-made speeds. In other words, what I'm saying, it goes from 2 months to 2 weeks or less. Now, let's put this in perspective. This is the month of June. What this means is this. In the old days, if you started a ship in June, it would take you 2 to 3 months to get to England. Then you'd have to sell your stuff, buy more stuff, which you hope, by the way, had not gone up in price from the time you last had contact with that area. And by the way, you hope the stuff you're selling hasn't gone down in price from the time you left port in New York. Then you bring it back all the while, and I mean, it would be 2 to 3 months. It might be January. Yeah, because if it takes you time to sell your materials and your produce and your freight and buy more, it could easily, if it took you a month to do that and then 3 months and 3 months, you could easily be in the year, in effect, our calendar year 2009 under the old days. It could be January if you took off in June. Now, think of the expenses, the extra insurance, the food that you're going to have to supply your crew, the payment to the crew, because time is money, you're going to have to pay them more. The chances of sinking really are greater. Not to mention all these price rises and declines which interfere with your market. All of that meant that when, and for an immigrant coming over here, that means to be an immigrant, you have to have enough to buy a ticket, feed your family for 3 months, and come over here. As one immigrant said, if I had that kind of money, I wouldn't come over here. Right? I mean, the reason I come over is because I'm destitute. But if I'm destitute and can't buy a ticket and 3 months' food for myself and my family, I can't very well come over. Immigration was rather low. Now, with the steamship, imagine this. January 1st, if you had a steamship leave New York City, it could get to Liverpool, sell the merchandise, get back And by the time it got back to New York Port, it could still be June. Now that is going to change things. That is a difference maker in bringing groups of the world closer to each other. And that's why steamships were a major innovation in the early 1800s. And Edward Collins was taking advantage of this situation to say, look, we now have steamship travel. Here's my idea. We have the surplus. Here's my idea. Give me $385,000. Now, when you're talking about a time when you've got surpluses, right? You know, we're talking about sometimes each year you might have $1 million surplus. Because we're talking about a time period when we only had 20 million Americans and they were averaging about $150 a year income. Money could go a lot farther. So, I mean, when you're talking about $1 million, that is huge, almost like $1 billion is today. Now, you talk about $385,000, that's big stuff when you're trying to balance budgets. That is a huge expense. And Edward Collins said, look, here's my idea. We could have an American steamship company. I'll be the captain. And here's the way we'll do it. I'll need $385,000. It's kind of startup costs. Because I need that to, I plan to charge about $200 a ticket for passengers. He had rates for freight. And he outlined this to Congress and said, but I'll need startup costs here, $385,000. He says, I hope I won't need any after this first year. But for the first year, I'll need that for startup costs. And here's my plan. I'll have a business going, and I can have a ship in New York, and on Monday, it will leave for Liverpool. See? Then I'll have another ship in Liverpool on Monday. It will leave for New York. The idea, by the way, is he's going to have four ships. Then the next, at the end of the next Monday, another ship leaves, because he has two of them in New York and two in Liverpool. Another one leaves New York for Liverpool, and then the next one leaves Liverpool for New York. So they're crossing each other in the ocean. But you notice, if it can be done in 12 or 13 days, they're landing before the next Monday, and then you can refurbish them, and then you can promise your customers regular Monday service, which we take for granted, but which was not the case. In those days, ships, when they got full, they took off. So you didn't exactly know when you'd take off, but he was promising regular. He says, look, I've got regular Monday service, and with four ships, I can run the whole thing. I will need this $385,000. Congress was interested. Well, I don't know. They said, well, what about the Constitution? And Collins said, ooh, thought I better read that. Because so he goes, he says, he was like W.C. Fields. You know, W.C. Fields was found reading a Bible on his deathbed. He's a comedian. And a friend of his came in and said, what are you reading that for? He said, I'm looking for loopholes. Collins was doing the same with the Constitution. He was looking for loopholes. And Article 1, Section 8 has what can Congress do? And it's the national defense is in there. And he thought, well, I don't know about that. And then he thought, well, maybe it could be. So what, the first he tried, he says, I'll make my ship available in case of war. See, that was clever, he thought. And then he noticed that the federal government had possibilities for the post office and post roads. And he said, I'll carry the mail. In fact, he called it the Collins Mail Steamship Company. He said, I'm the constitutional company. So now he had come up with this idea, I'll deliver the mail back from England to America. And so the Collins Steamship Company, the Collins Mail Steamship Company, is wanting to be in business. He says, Congress, he answered the constitutional question, I need $385,000. And Congress was beginning to think about it. He said, oh, one more thing I neglected to mention. I'll need $3 million to build the ships. A minor clerical error that he needed to straighten out. He's going to be asking for $3 million and $385,000. That's going to wipe any surplus out. And so that's a tough decision. Congress met, they voted, and they decided to give Edward Collins a subsidy, $385,000 for his steamship company. The United States sacrificed a surplus for a steamship company, but we said it will be good. It will give America a world presence, and we'll have this company going back and forth. And sure enough, Collins got his ships going because he got the money for that too. And the ships were going back and forth the whole year. And at the end of the year, he was in business. And when he came back to Congress at the end of the year, he was shaking their hands and they were congratulating him. He said, now, one thing I need to point out, I actually need an increase in my subsidy next year. I actually need an increase in my subsidy. And they said, well, why? He said, well, see, nobody really knew that I was in business for the first 6 months. And so I was carrying ships that were almost empty. And so I didn't make any money. I was losing money. Now, in the second half of the year, I did much better, but not enough to cover the losses, which were so unexpected. So I need over $400,000 next year. Congress voted $400,000 plus for Edward Collins in his steamship company the next year. Collins continued his business. The next year he came before Congress and he requested a subsidy of a little bit over $500,000. And when the Congress was quite wondering why, he said, I had one of my ships was out of service. And I had to recalk it. It was terrible. And I couldn't have my regular monthly service. And I lost business. But now it's fixed. But see, the caulking fees cause problems too. And therefore, I'll need over $500,000. The next year, he came before Congress and requested $600,000. The next year he came before Congress, and some people were getting a little cynical. One of those people was a man named Cornelius Vanderbilt, nicknamed the Commodore, who got his start. If you were just 1 mile, as you know, from the Hudson River, he was going up and down the Hudson River as a young man. If you'd been on the shores here at Irvington, 80 years ago, you would have seen him. And Vanderbilt was running a steamship company of his own privately, a private company. And he said, what I am witnessing here is ridiculous. And then he got this idea. He said, whatever Collins asks for the next year, I'll promise to do it for half price. It's like a blue light special, you know. I'm going to do it for half price, half price. Collins promises half price, or Vanderbilt promises half price. Collins, sure enough, ups the request, $700,000. I know this is not a class in math. What would Vanderbilt be asking, saying that he could do the service for? Right, $350,000. That was the offer. So Vanderbilt says, I'll do it for $350,000. Now, this is interesting because you have Collins on the scene, who says, I want my $700,000 to continue, subsidy to continue my business. And Vanderbilt says, I'll do it for half price, so I'll do it for $350,000, which is less than Collins asked in the first place. Congress, therefore, has two offers on the table. Don't they? They debated it. And I have a question for you. How many of you think Congress took Vanderbilt's offer? Raise your hand if you think they took Vanderbilt's offer. David back there, tentatively. Yeah, it looks like three people. Are you raising your hand? Halfway. There is no halfway when you vote.
you're either voting for Collins or you're voting for Vanderbilt. Now, how many think they gave him a sub or took Vanderbilt's offer? Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4. Looks like 6. Okay. And you don't think they did that? You're still not sure. How many think they did not take Vanderbilt's offer? In other words, they said, no, we turned Vanderbilt down. We're going to take Collins at $700,000. It's possible, but they didn't. They only did one. So, yeah, oh, look at this—a huge. Why do you think they wouldn't take? Why do you think they wouldn't take Vanderbilt's half-price offer? Sunk costs. Yeah, elaborate on that. I know we have an air conditioner here to compete with.
They already sunk a bunch of money into Collins, and they'd be losing face if they gave up on him.
He's saying they sunk costs into Vanderbilt or to Collins, and they'd be losing face. It's interesting because I've looked at the congressional record on this back in the 1800s, 1840s, when this in 50s when these votes were taking place. It was called the Congressional Globe. But yeah, I looked, but as you know, though, it's hard to read. And you say, well, we've sunk too much into Collins. We don't dare turn away now. Yeah, that's kind of not the sort of thing. But I think you're right. I think your point is well taken, actually. But I didn't actually find that too much. What would you be saying on the Senate floor? Yeah, well, of course, if you subsidize one company, subsidizing another one, because Vanderbilt said he'd do the mail too. Yeah, that was one of the things. He said, I'll do the mail too. Yeah, he even said he'd charge less for a letter. And that, but we'll put that aside. So, yeah, anybody else? Any other comments? Yes?
Maybe they rationalized it as Collins was a former congressman and he was working for the public good.
Yeah.
Vanderbilt was a robber baron. Therefore, evil business.
He's an evil person. Really, a lot of it is maybe simpler than you might think. A lot of the explanation, and I think you're hitting on some of the subtle motives. I do. Well, sort of. I think you're getting closer because the argument that in print was, how do we know Vanderbilt can do it? Right? He says he can do it. What if he can't? Then we have no one. Then if Collins is out and Vanderbilt can't do it, we end up with nothing. And that's terrible. So Collins won the vote. The majority in this case is correct. They voted against Vanderbilt, and they voted to give Collins the subsidy. The majority is correct. Collins was so happy. Not long after he went down to the New York Harbor, pleased, happy, probably whistling a tune. I don't know for sure, but I do know he saw something that made him very distressed. He looked out, and right next to his ship, right next to it, waiting to take off at exactly the same time his ship was another ship that he had not seen before. And he didn't have to wildly use his imagination to figure out whose ship that was, because on the side of the new ship was written the ship's name, the Vanderbilt. It was waiting there in New York Harbor. And Vanderbilt, in effect, was saying, nobody tells me I can't succeed. What do you mean you don't think I can do the job? I'll show you. I'll do it with no subsidy. I don't care if I don't get any subsidy. I'm going to do the steamship service and take people and freight and everything over to Liverpool and back with no subsidy. Furthermore, he started out by saying, and I'll beat Collins across the ocean. And he ran, and he won what was known then as the Blue Ribbon Cup for the fastest time overseas, 11 and a half days. Now, Vanderbilt discovered something after that fast opening trip, and that is that he used fuel very rapidly going those rates of speed. Today, if we were to look at it, it would be something like the fuel usage on an automobile, which we're sensitive to today. Right? Are you more fuel efficient when you go in a car if you go 50 miles an hour or 80 miles an hour? Yeah. It's more fun going 80, isn't it? No, but we're more fuel efficient going 50. Right. Vanderbilt discovered the same thing, and he said, hey, I'm not getting a subsidy for my fuel, right? And so he therefore went slower. Vanderbilt went slower. He says, I've got to go slow to conserve fuel. Vanderbilt said, what I've got to figure out is how to save money. That was one of the things he did. He saved on insurance because he said, I'm going to be so safe I won't need insurance. And he never did have a crash. And he saved on insurance. Another way he saved is he hired young people, teenagers, high school age students. And what he had them do, he hired them both in Liverpool and in New York. And he gave them a percentage of the ticket price for everybody they could persuade to get on his ship. You know, like kind of the old sandwich board, go Vanderbilt. And so if they could rustle up business for him, he gave them a percentage of the ticket price. And he told them, hey, look, here's something to your advantage when you're going for ticket prices. I have the cheapest trade in the world. And they said, really? He said, yes, that's going to be one of the features. Vanderbilt worked off of something economists today call fixed costs. Vanderbilt discovered whether his ship was full with 600 or 700 passengers or whether it only had 100, his costs were roughly the same either way. He had to get a crew, and he had to get supplies for the crew and all of this, whether you had 100 people or 700 people. Therefore, he said, if it's no greater cost to me to have 100 or 700, I've got to do everything I can to fill that ship up. So he cut the ticket prices as low as $30 and $35. He figured if I can get 600 or 700 people at $30 or $35, I'm in better shape than Collins, who's getting sometimes only 100 or 150 at his rate of $150, or he started at 200, but he came down too. So if he's charging $100 or $150, and he only has 150 people, he's not making as much as I do when I fill up my ship. The other thing Vanderbilt did, he said, now that I've got him aboard my ship, I make money on the food. Vanderbilt made some money on the concessions. He invented some of the concessions. Vanderbilt is one of the inventors of the potato chip. They were originally called Saratoga chips. And Vanderbilt helped invent them. So he had junk food. If you want to complain, he didn't have always the most nutritious. But he was able to make some money on the food. Now, what I'm getting at, and I think you can see where I'm leading, is that Vanderbilt, by getting a lot of passengers, getting the students working for him, the discount rates, and saving money on the insurance, and saving money on fuel by going slower, Vanderbilt, at the end of the year in business, he made a profit with no subsidy. This made it fascinating in Congress the next year when Collins came back. Vanderbilt was turning a profit after only his first year in business. Collins came up to Congress and said, this year, I need this amount. $858,000. And many congressmen said, whoa, why that huge increase? And he said, because I've lost business to Vanderbilt. My ships have been practically empty. They're all going on Vanderbilt and his cheap fares. Therefore, I was losing money every time one of my ships went out of the harbor. And I'll need $858,000. Congress debated this subject. And I have a question for you. How many of you think Congress gave Collins the $858,000. Gave it to him. I see a lot of hands. Saw a tentative one there. Yeah, okay. She says, they did it. They did it. Okay. How many think they didn't do it? They did not do it. This is going to be close. Let me see the hands. I want to get... How many again think they did give him the money? By a very slight margin of two, I got the majority says that they gave him the money. But this is really a close vote. This was a very close vote here. And it was closer in Congress, too. This is 1852. In this case, the majority is correct. They gave him the subsidy. They gave Collins $858,000. Looking at the congressional record was interesting. I have to admit to a certain excitement getting the dates and everything and looking up to see what was going to be the rationalization. Senator William Seward of New York said this in defense of Collins. Yes, I'm voting for Collins. Yes, I'm voting to give him $858,000. There are some people in this Senate who want to desert their friends in time of need. They're not loyal. But just because somebody comes along for 1 year and does the job a little bit better, there are people who want to just throw Collins overboard. Not me. Yeah. He neglected to say, of course, that it was other people's money he was being loyal with, right? Yeah. This was something that was missing in the congressional record from his explanation. Congress voted Collins the $858,000. Now, Collins tried to figure out, because he was sitting back there, okay, I won the vote. Good, 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 good. How can I advertise myself in a way that makes me look flattering next to Vanderbilt? He thought, well, I can't do it on a cost basis. I charge more than he does. Anybody think of something Collins might be able to use to his advantage? Yeah, government endorsed. Yeah, he actually tried to slip that one in there. Yes.
For the history that he had been in business.
Yes. The guy who's been in business a long time, the veteran, and the guy who is the fastest service. Right? If he said, I get there ahead of Vanderbilt. So he started advertising, if your time means something, go on the Collins Mail Steamship Company. If you are a person of importance, then a day in your life means something and you need to think about Edward Collins. See? If you're a worthless and insignificant person, then just go ahead and go on Vanderbilt's ship and see if I care. Yeah. Do you like that advertisement? If you're a person of importance, if a day in your life is important, go on Collins. Well, I have to say this. Vanderbilt had a little bit of a perverse sense of humor. Because what happened was when Collins came out with those advertisements is Vanderbilt started ramping his ships up and just blew right out of the port ahead of Collins. And see, Collins had been promising, I'm the fastest. And he says, well, you're not supposed to do that. You can't afford it. The fuel costs to do this stuff. You know, and Vanderbilt was just racing. And Collins, you know, catch him. Catch up with him. And Collins was just hustling on that ship to get ahead of him. And Vanderbilt, it turns, and he did pass Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt had given instructions. Let him pass you after a while and then drop back. He won't know how close you are. Then go back to the slow speed. Collins, meanwhile, will never know how close you are, so he'll just keep racing all the way across, and at least we can make him use more fuel. Collins began racing very fast. too fast. Very fast. How many have seen one of the versions of the movie The Titanic? That Titanic was not the first ship to hit an iceberg. It happens that speedy Mr. Collins, in his race across the ocean, whacked into an iceberg, and it happened to be a ship that he had 450 passengers. The ship sank. There was another ship nearby that quick came over to try to see if they could get any passengers. None were alive by the time they got there. They saw some driftwood. Collins lost one of his ships, and in the process, 450 people were killed. Collins had another ship leave Liverpool, England, in April 1855, and it hasn't arrived yet. Now, we may still have some bureaucrat over there waiting for its arrival, but it's not going to do Collins any good at this point. So what percentage, what percentage of Collins' fleet has disappeared now? Half. Right, he had four ships, and he's lost two. One's sunk, and one's disappeared. So Collins now has a request for Congress for an emergency appropriation to get a new ship. It's going to cost $1 million. An emergency $1 million appropriation to replace the ship that hit the iceberg. He did want to replace the ship that disappeared, but they said it may come in still in port. And so therefore we can't do that one. But the one that hit the iceberg, they were willing at least to consider. So Congress has an emergency appropriation request, $1 million to build a ship to keep Collins in the steamship business. And I have a question for you. How many of you think that Congress voted $1 million for Mr. Collins? Good, okay. You're voting, yes. I'm taking careful notes here. How many think they did not give him $1 million? By at least a 2 and maybe a 3 to 1 margin, the majority of you say that Congress gave Collins, you cynical people, 3 to 1 margin. You think Congress gave Collins $1 million to replace the ship that whacked into an iceberg? In this case, the majority. Is correct. They did. They gave Collins $1 million. Collins built the ship quickly to get back in the race. Man, it was a rapid building of that ship to get back in. He named it the Adriatic over one of the European seas. He got the ship back in. He built the ship very quickly. He built it maybe too quickly. Well, I know what you're thinking. It went from New York, and let me use the official nautical terminology here to describe what happened to that ship. It went out, and it is the nautical, the Navy, it took water. It took water. And so it was taking water, and what that meant, that on the ship, see, they had not caulked it properly because it was too quick, and so it was leaking. And so the people aboard the ship became accustomed to this motion. Yeah. Maybe that's the first government bailout. I'm sorry for that. I'm sorry. you're laughing. These people are bailing for their lives. They're in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, frantically, day and night, trying to get that water out of the ship. You may think, after the Titanic and all those others, you'd think they're, but it made it. I do not know the accounts. I've read accounts of it. In my image, I can't prove this, but my image, when they came and hit England, you know, they arrived at their destination, I could just see them getting out, kissing, you know, land. Well, I mean, they have to get out in their soggy pants and all, but they're just land, kissing the earth. They're so excited. And nobody died. Everybody lived through the voyage, which pleased Collins very much. Since his ships had a death rate, but he was pleased, but he was not so pleased the next Tuesday. What he was doing Tuesday service, because it took him a long time to get the ship repaired. Nobody wanted to be on that ship going back. It had zero passengers. And this left Collins with a dilemma, because if the ship has zero passengers, he can't very well sail it. And so he thought, what we need to do, he thought, maybe I can repair it. Really, really good repair, not just this kind of superficial stuff. And then he thought, or I could sell it at auction and build another one. And he thought, if I sell it at auction, I probably won't get it. I mean, I know I won't get $1 million, but I'll get something. And then maybe I can build another one. Because repairing this ship, it's bad. It's terrible. It was poorly constructed. So Collins said, yeah, I'll sell it at auction. And he sold it at auction at a loss. The top bidder was such that the ship sold at a loss of $990,000. Yeah, he got $10,000 for the ship that he paid $1 million. And Collins, I was reading one account that said, oh, this is outrageous, this $1 million ship selling for $10,000. But then I read another account that I thought really hit the nail much more on the head, and it said, would you have bought that ship? Who wants to buy a ship that leaks, right? And has all those repair issues. And so maybe that one author said he thought that was about the market value of the ship. Was for the wood and whatever was about $10,000. So anyway, whatever the case, Collins sold the ship for $10,000, and he needs to come before Congress.
What year now?
1856, yes. He's coming before Congress.
He
said, how did he get back? Isn't it pitiful when you have to take Vanderbilt's ships to get back here? He had to be sure he would make it, you know. So Vanderbilt is back in Washington with a request before Congress for an emergency appropriation. And one thing that Collins made clear right off, this is no request for $1 million. He says, $10,000 right here in my hand. $10,000. I do request $990,000 to go with my $10,000 that I bring to Congress to show you to build another ship to keep me in the steamship business. And I have a question for you. When Congress heard this request from Mr. Collins, how many of you think they gave him the $990,000. Okay, I see. One of them said, he's not going to get me this time. I saw a new hand here. One, yeah, you're not gonna. 1, 2, 3, 4. 22. How many think they did not give him the million, the $990,000? 13. 1920. I get 23 to 22 that say they did not give him the subsidy. 23 to 22. This is a close vote. The majority say they did not give him a subsidy. And in this case, the majority. Is right. Is right. Yeah. Now, the Vanderbilt is the first chapter in my book, The Myth of the Robber Barons. And I had it there as the first chapter because chronologically he's the first story of the rise of the great entrepreneurs. However, it fits. I'm telling Collins a story here, and I have a whole paragraph that I devote to quotations from congressmen. And can you detect any unhappiness with Mr. Collins in these quotations? Because they do turn him down. In fact, not only do they turn him down for building the new ship, they turn him down for any new subsidy. Collins gets nothing. No new ship, no subsidy. Listen to this. Senator Judah Benjamin of Louisiana, quote, "I believe the Collins line has been most miserably managed." Senator Robert Hunter of Virginia, quote, "The whole system was wrong. It ought to have been left like any other trade to competition." Senator John Thompson of Kentucky said, quote, "Give neither this line nor any other line a subsidy. Let the Collins line die." "I want a tabula rasa, the whole thing wiped out, and a new beginning." We had that new beginning. 1858 is going to be the first year we get no subsidies for Mr. Collins whatsoever. We spent $11 million on steamship subsidies, and we were back to having a national debt. The national debt we spent on some other things, and we had the Mexican War debt too, was right before the Civil War, was about $30 million. $11 million we spent on steamship subsidies. Over a third of the entire national debt on subsidies for steamships. All the time we had Vanderbilt to do the trade with no subsidy. And by the way, Collins went out of business in 6 months. That did not create a problem of competition of any kind. England had two companies. One still exists. The Cunard Steamship Company was competing. They had another steamship company called the Inman Steamship Company, both of which were sailing steamships along with Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt then, when the Civil War came, by the way, donated one of his ships to the U.S. government saying, "Hunt down those Confederate ships," and made that offer. After the Civil War, Vanderbilt sold his steamships and went into railroads and became a prime owner of the New York Central Railroad, which became the biggest railroad ultimately in the United States. Vanderbilt became the first American during the decade of the 1870s. He became the first American to be worth $100 million. He is the first, therefore, of the so-called robber barons to be worth the first American to be worth $100 million. I think this is instructive because one of the questions it's good to ask when we're looking at wealth and people talk about equality and people having much is to look at, this guy got his $100 million by producing a good product at a competitive price. He became the wealthiest man in the United States by producing a product that was in high demand at a good price. And if we look, there's a continuity with all of that. We could go to the next stage is the first American to be worth $1 billion. John D. Rockefeller, the cheapest oil in the world. The most recent wealthiest people in the United States are Sam Walton and Bill Gates. It's interesting to observe that. We all know somebody times jerks win the lottery and end up getting wealthy and all that. But the people often who have become the wealthiest are people who gave customers, they provided service. They gave customers something they really wanted and they did so at a competitive price. I wish I could say, boy, did we learn our lesson. We never did that again. We went through another unfortunate episode, which becomes chapter 2 of the book, The Transcontinental Railroads. Have some of you in maybe in history classes studied a little bit with the Transcontinentals? Well, what we did was the Congress said, hey, we learned something from Collins. Don't give somebody a subsidy. What we're going to do with the Transcontinentals, we're going to give two companies a subsidy and let them compete. So the Union Pacific and Central Pacific each got subsidies. And the idea was they'll compete for the subsidies. We'll give them free land, and we'll also give them $16,000 a mile on flat land. And since we know that there's, right, Rocky Mountains there, we're going to give them extra money, $48,000 for going up Rocky Mountains per mile. And sure enough, we get going, and we're paying people by the mile. And the idea is, see, they'll build and they'll compete for the subsidies. And we'll connect America with this transcontinental railroad, the Union Pacific and Central Pacific, from California to Nebraska, and then we'll connect the East Coast, and the whole nation will be tied together. Well, the Union Pacific was doing fine as long as it was in Nebraska and on flat land. Then it got to the Rocky Mountains, and it thought, ooh, granted, we've got these mountains, and there's probably a way to weave our way in there and find some fairly flat grade, but I don't know how to do it. And by the time we figure it out, the other side's going to be building all the way across. So the Union Pacific, in effect, made the decision to go up the mountain and down the mountain. Now, people pointed out, wait a minute, nobody can take that. I mean, a grade over about 6 or 7% is too steep. And they said, well, yeah, but we're being paid by the mile. And so they get up and they go down. And then they get down the mountain, and the Central Pacific is starting in California. And it's coming, chugging across California and Nevada. The Union Pacific is now across the Rockies, and they're going here, and they're coming along and getting closer. And it's interesting because the invention of dynamite occurred right around the 1860s. The Union Pacific could have written a book called Dynamite, Its Uses and Abuses. It's good for knocking down mountainous terrain and getting a flat grade. But they were using it in the middle of the night to sneak over to the Central Pacific and blow their track up. And then they'd say, see, they didn't complete their mile, so they don't get any money for that, and then we'll build. Now, here's one. I've got a really tough multiple-choice question for you. What do you think the Central Pacific did in response? A, they said, aw, shucks. I guess we're not going to get any more miles of railroad. B, they pointed their fingers and said, you're bad people. C, they took dynamite to the Union Pacific and blew their track up. Yeah, and I have a question for you, right? No, right, it's C. And Congress had to get involved because both sides were doing it to one another. And Congress said, you will not, nobody blows up anybody's track anymore. Nobody's getting any money. Okay, so they can't do that anymore. Here they come together. They're going through the West, Central Pacific, and watch, here they're coming. They're coming. They parallel each other, both demanding money for the mileage. They refuse to meet. So then Congress has to get together. You will meet at Promontory Point, Utah. Nowhere but that. And nobody gets any money for any mileage outside of Promontory Point, Utah. And so they meet. They have a golden spike. Heard about it? Yes. Grenville Dodge of the Union Pacific took a whack at whacking in the golden spike and missed. The president of the Central Pacific, the Leland Stanford, who also became governor of California, and founder of Stanford University for his son, Leland Stanford Jr., took a whack and missed also. And finally, they got a foreman to whack in the golden spike because neither of the presidents could do it. Then they all got drunk. Somebody stole the golden spike while this happened. And that's the story of our first transcontinental railroad. We spent $60 million and we gave away 60 million acres of land. And that is what we had because you couldn't go all the way across it because of the mountainous problem. James J. Hill came along and he said, "This is stupid." He says, "I am going to show the world how to build a real transcontinental." And he started in St. Paul, Minnesota, and built the Great Northern Railroad across the country to Seattle. Do we have anybody here from Seattle? Oh, a bunch. Do they teach you about Hill in your schools? Do they? What do they say? Good things, I hope. No?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's a while back. Yes, but he came to Seattle, and he did it slowly and methodically. He would make each part of the country he went across profitable, and then when it was making money, he'd build another section of track. He'd get wheat in North Dakota. Then he'd go into copper country in Montana. And then when he hit the Rocky Mountains, he went back to the journals of Lewis and Clark to go back and find out how did they weave through here on a flat grade. He discovered and had somebody searching for what he found in the Lewis and Clark journal called the Marias Pass. And he had somebody actually discover that, rediscovered, I should say, and he built his railroad through that path on a relatively flat grade, and he had a railroad that was fantastic. He was doing exporting apples in Washington and timber. Frederick Weyerhaeuser, his neighbor in St. Paul, he got to come into Washington and start a lumber company so that he knew he could have traffic coming back and forth. And this railroad, when the panic of 1893 hit, all the other transcontinentals went broke. The Great Northern was making a profit. James J. Hill, who was an immigrant to this country, did it. He was a one-eyed immigrant. Yeah, he lost an eye with a bow and arrow accident as a kid. Yeah, some people, "Oh, I'm going to get on disability." Not James J. Hill. Here's a guy who builds a transcontinental railroad, taking the lesson of Vanderbilt. And I'm pleased to make a report on this, because it's kind of exciting to make, and that is, we're going to see an instance of learning from history. American congressmen, after the Union Pacific disaster, more and more began to take the position, we may be successful in this country, we may flop, but we're going to do it not on the basis of trying to subsidize some industry. We're going to let our entrepreneurs and turn them loose and see what they can come up with. And what we find is, in an atmosphere of minimum subsidies, now there were protective tariffs here and there, I have to admit that, but generally speaking, we're not going to get financial subsidies. You look at industries here that begin to flourish after the Civil War, like steel, oil, chemicals. The major industries of their day, and what we find is American entrepreneurs step in to those industries and defeat time and again the competition from Europe. They do it without subsidies, and the United States is going to become a major leader in steel. Who's the entrepreneur in steel?
Carnegie.
Carnegie is an immigrant also. Isn't that interesting? A lot of times the advantage an immigrant has is an immigrant is not fixed in old patterns. Hill was not fixed in old patterns. Carnegie obviously wasn't too. The innovative urge to leave their old country when it's not working is the same mentality sometimes that results in tremendous financial contributions. Carnegie, when he came in and started the Carnegie Steel, the going price of steel rails was $56 a ton. 25 years later, he was selling steel rails at $11.50 a ton. He innovated with he didn't invent these processes, Bessemer and Open Hearth, but he adopted them quickly. He did double entry bookkeeping. He did things that saved him little bits of money. For example, they had a device that called a scaler that they rolled across a steel rail because it would smooth it, because it was a rough product, and therefore it created shavings. And Carnegie said, "What are we doing with our scale?" They said, "Well, we're throwing it away." And he says, "Why? Collect your scale and throw it back in the pot." And then he said, "I wonder if my competitors are throwing their scale away." And he had people go out to their garbage, bring their stuff back to his shop, put it in his pot, and he's out there selling steel rails. That's why the first rails built in Japan were Carnegie steel, transferred on the Great Northern Railroad to Washington, exported to Japan, exports to China. That was often a common process. We see this. John D. Rockefeller, there's some things I've just got to say. I've got to say them, and I'm so excited. He sold oil at 8 cents a gallon. Now, I know, that would be more than $1.60 in money back then, so it's not like it's an 8 cents in today's money. So I understand that. But still, it's better than we're getting today. 8 cents a gallon. And nobody in the world could do it that cheaply, although some tried and had some market share. Carnegie sold. Now, his company, what's the name of his company? Carnegie's. Rockefeller's company?
Standard Oil.
Yeah, my fault. Rockefeller's company, Standard Oil. That company, just get ready for this, it had a 60% market share of all the oil sold in the world in the 1890s. One American company sold 60% of all the oil that anybody in the world used. One American company. Boy, I'm just thinking of my gas pump and the way it just whirls when I pull that pump, and it just whirls. And we're aligned. So much of it's imported. I have to say that again. John D. So it rolls off the tongue. You've got to forgive me. It rolls off the tongue. I've got to do it again. John D. Rockefeller had a 60% market share of all the oil sold in the world, with one American company had a 60% market share. And that's how he got to be the first billionaire in U.S. history. He made a fraction of a cent on each gallon of oil that was sold. And he had the foresight to say, my goal is to make it for 6 cents, sell it for 8, and use the 2 cents for research and development. Because Rockefeller saw research and finding new uses for oil was the key to success. For example, other companies would take a barrel of oil out of the ground. They would heat it to get the kerosene. But yeah, and what was the kerosene used for back then? Lamps, right. This is not for cars. We didn't have cars then. We're doing it for lamps. And they found out if they did a heating process called cracking, they could get 50% of a barrel of oil and make it into kerosene. And so what the oil producers in the Cleveland area did was they said, oh, good, we've got our kerosene here with half. And then they took the other half and said, oh, we don't need this, and just dumped it in the Cuyahoga River. Rockefeller was a strong Christian, and he spoke very softly. He says, God didn't make junk. You know, if that barrel of oil is in the ground, God has a purpose for everything in that, and so we just need to have our scientists figure out what it is. And so he had his research and development team working. See, he'd take the half for kerosene, and then they'd be working on experiments with the other half. And they would make things like Vaseline, the various kinds of candle waxes. They even did a detergent. They had a soap, a type of detergent that they were, as a byproduct that they were able to do. Naphtha, paving. Various kinds of tar. They had lubricating oils not kerosene, but a kind of lubricating. All of these. And then he went into business making these byproducts and selling those. And then after that, he thought, well, I'll go up to my competitors and say, don't bother to dump that in the Cuyahoga River. We'll even come by and just pick it up and take it off your hands. And so he'd use his competitor's byproduct. Rockefeller is the first environmentalist. Yeah. And also he saved the whales because it was whale oil that was being used before that, and it was expensive. So Rockefeller saved the whales, and he saved the Cuyahoga River. And it was so cheap, people could light their homes with kerosene for 1 cent an hour. Marvelous. I don't want to end on a distressing note, so I'm going to pass over this quickly. His competitors didn't like him. They said he was bad. They implemented the Sherman Antitrust Act against him and forced him to divide his company into 30 separate companies. And he could only own one of them. And no company had the capital, therefore, to go when the oil was discovered in the Middle East and make long-term investments and contracts or in Mexico and those places that could today be salvaging tremendously cheap prices. But we can't look back on history. It just didn't play out that way. In 1911, he was broken up, which was an irony because Rockefeller was already losing market share. The U.S. Geological Survey issued a report in 1890 that said, there is no oil in the state of Texas. And Rockefeller believed it. And so he didn't go into Texas. So when Gulf Oil and other companies came into Texas, when oil was discovered in the early 1900s, Standard wasn't there. So his market share dropped to 65% of the American market. He had about 90% of the American market and 60% of the world market. Well, he dropped to 65% of the American market and even less, of course, in the world market, and was broken up under the Sherman Antitrust Act. But put that aside. I want to end on a positive note, and then we'll take questions. Look at the contributions that this generation of entrepreneurs, and I call those people who produce competitive products at a good price, market entrepreneurs, those who rely on subsidies like Collins and the Union Pacific, I call them political entrepreneurs. They try to succeed by using the government to make a profit. And Vanderbilt and Hill and Rockefeller tried to make money by producing a good product at a competitive price and win by appealing to consumers. Those market entrepreneurs pulled the United States into world competitive dominance. When you compete in steel, oil, and in chemicals, Herbert Dow was our man there. When you're competing in those products, you are not going to be defeated in a world war. You know what I mean? We are going to be able to militarily take care of ourselves. But way beyond that, we're going to be competing in the products that are going to make up the essence of progress in the late 1800s, economic progress in early 1900s, contribute to prosperity. That generation after the Civil War has a claim, along with our World War II generation, and I would say the Founding Father generation, to being America's greatest generation. They came in, and America was a second-rate power. During their lifetimes, they pushed America, both with entrepreneurship and by working in these industries, pulled America into world dominance so that, say, when the auto industry becomes significant in the next century, well, I guess we're a little competitive, huh? You know, the best steel and the best oil? Henry Ford, who became the second billionaire in U.S. history, owed a lot to what the first billionaire was able to contribute. America, thus, in the 1900s, has a tremendous edge because of the productivity of the entrepreneurs of the late 1800s. They, too, have a claim to being the greatest generation. Thank you. Yeah. Well, we've got to have some questions. We've got to have some questions here. Yes?
Where can I buy your book?
That's nice of you to say that. I need to get you on the advertising team here. Now, I think they have copies here. I believe they do. I don't know if someone is. We do? Yeah. Is it $10? I'm not sure, but they'll have copies here. Yeah. There's a chapter on Rockefeller, too.
Has it been received?
How's the book been received? Well, a lot of the historians are not too happy. Exceptions would be my colleague, Professor Beto, and Professor Hart and Back have been supportive at all times. They're good colleagues. Generally speaking, the historical profession likes the view that the government was needed to break these people up. I have a chapter in the last chapter of the book. It's called Entrepreneurs Versus the Historians. And I look at the textbook treatment of some of these entrepreneurs. And I'd hoped, I think we've made a difference. The year it came out, I had an article in the Wall Street Journal, and I was talking about some of the entrepreneurs in the textbooks. And I was disappointed that in the next edition of the textbooks that I criticized, there were no changes. So you sort of start slowly in this thing, right? And then you make progress over time. But a lot of the book is used on a lot of campuses. It's gone into 5 editions. So it has sold 35,000 copies. Sometimes entrepreneurs buy it and give it to their staff. And so that's been good. I felt that we had to tell a story of this generation that showed the value that they added to this country. And in many places, it's been well received, and I'm very pleased. Thanks. Yes? A chapter on Bill Gates. We could do something with the modern group. It would be fun to do something on the modern group, and that may happen someday. You'd have Bill Gates, but there are a lot of interesting modern entrepreneurs. For example, I like Herb Kelleher at Southwest Airlines. The other airlines are all taking subsidies and are losing money, and Herb Kelleher is not taking federal subsidies and is making profits every quarter. Now, where have we heard that story before? Herb Kelleher, for example, I mean, this is the way an entrepreneur thinks, and it's why these stories are useful to tell. Kelleher discovered when he was doing airline activity and trying to run Southwest Airlines that one of the problems in an airline business is that you need to get as many flights during a day as you can, but part of the problem is every airline had 15 minutes, what they called turnaround time. That is from the time people get off the plane to clean it up, because you have to get rid of the pillows and you have to do some vacuuming, you have to get the litter out, and then you have to refuel and you have to get the baggage off. And there may be other things too, but those are the ones that just come to mind. And I'm sure there are all sorts of checking of parts. You know, you have to do tests of the airplane. And it took a long time. And Kelleher said, if I could cut this time to 10 minutes, I could get in a couple extra flights. And if I could get in a couple extra flights, that would help me to be able to make a profit. And also it would help me to serve more customers because I would have more flights going so they would think of me more. And so he asked the other airlines, okay, let's look into this idea of a 10-minute turnaround. And they sent experts over there, and every one of them said, it can't be done, and here's why. It can't be done, and here's why. It can't be done, it can't be done, it can't be done, it can't be done, it can't be done. So then Kelleher kicked them all out of his office. He pulled random people in his company into his office and said, hey, I've got this idea, guys. Let's try for a 10-minute turnaround. I don't know how we're going to do it. That's your job. I have bonuses for you. Let's see if you can figure it out. A year later, Southwest Airlines has the 10-minute turnaround. Henry Ford did the same thing with curved windshields. They told him, oh, he said you had to have windshields in 2 pieces in the early days. And he said, that's inefficient. It would be nice if we could have a curved windshield. So he asked the companies that were making cars, General Motors and others, How about this curved windshield? Oh, no. And they all said, it can't be done. He did the same thing. He pulled people out of his company and said, hey, guys, let's figure out how to do a curved windshield. Let me just turn you guys loose and come back when you've got it done. They did it. These kinds of stories are suggestive that there are not a lot of limits to creative ingenuity. That entrepreneurs have done, that entrepreneurs didn't even know 10 years ago I wanted YouTube. They invented it though. I mean, at least the 10-minute turnaround, we can figure out they wanted it. We wanted it, but now they're inventing things we didn't even know we wanted. It is really an amazing force. Any other questions? Yes?
You talked about...
Speak up, because I know we're competing with the air conditioning here. American entrepreneurs, can we compare them with other countries? Yes, it would be interesting to take a look at other countries. One of the problems with the other countries is that they have a much more active state. So what we find is that entrepreneurs end up migrating over here. How many have heard of Igor Sikorsky? What did he invent? Helicopter. He was stifled in Russia. And all sorts of administrative apparatus. He migrates to the United States and invents the helicopter over here. All you have to do a lot of times is provide low tax, limited government, and allow people to keep most of what they produce, and we just become kind of a magnet. And that's where we get the Sikorskys, the Carnegies, and the Hills, which then become the entrepreneurs of the next generation. Other countries sometimes produce good entrepreneurs too. But Andy Grove at Intel is an immigrant. We often, with our atmosphere, attract them over here, and they end up, from Einstein and on up, we end up getting the value of those entrepreneurs. Yes, sir. Yeah, the question is, how does Congress avoid repercussions for these disasters here? And I want to say, some politicians came out better than others because some were voting against it. And I want to commend a U.S. president who is rarely commended, Franklin Pierce. How many have been in classes where the teacher lavished praise on Franklin Pierce? Well, I'm not going to lavish praise. He vetoed the bill one time. Congress had to override a Franklin Pierce veto to get one of those subsidies in there. So I'm saying some people could say, you're saying, how could Congress do it? Some people said we had it figured out, and some said, hey, it was a learning curve, but then we botched it again with the Transcontinentals. It took some errors. There were a lot of people who said, look, England's up here, we're here. It makes sense to try for the subsidy to kick us up. And we just simply flopped a couple times before we realized that a relatively free market, limited government, low taxes was a much better strategy. Yeah. Yes? Say that again.
So that would make him a monopoly, but he was really trying to produce the best product for the lowest price.
Right.
So, I guess what I'm thinking about is, the modern pharmaceutical companies that are obviously a monopoly because they're the only ones producing, a certain drug, but they're making a really, really high profit. It doesn't seem to be. So I guess what is of those two instances, and my second question would be,
well, if you think about it, I'll try to answer your first one. The pharmaceuticals are a different case because a lot goes into research and development with pharmaceuticals. And because so much, you might end up researching a product For example, you've got Eli Lilly, you have Merck and some of the others. One of the inventions they were working on for a while was artificial insulin, you know, for diabetic patients. Well, a lot of that, those experiments for artificially processed insulin were unsuccessful. And, you know, you fail on those, people can get hurt. And so it took a while to really get, they said, we want to make sure this doesn't have lasting effects that are negative, right? It takes a while. And the point is, if you invent, insulin was not really developed till the 1920s, and then this brand of insulin came a little bit later. You have to really make sure you've got lawsuits. Then you have to have contingencies for that. To make and sell a good drug of some kind that really has a popular use takes a lot of investment. So oftentimes you're saying, geez, they can make this little pill for 38 cents and they're selling it for $20. But a lot of that's to cover failed experiments and the high overhead. Plus with the Pure Food and Drug Administration, they're charging enormous. They have huge costs that they... Yeah, but I don't consider some of these monopolies. They're oligopolies. They have a large market share. A monopoly has 100%.
Okay.
Rockefeller was simply a large, or we call him an oligopolist, not a monopolist. But okay. Even in the United States, there were always 50 oil companies.
But I see their motivation as trying to produce the best product at the lowest
right.
price.
Yeah.
So, like, there's been a huge shift in the motivation, in my opinion.
Maybe, but some may disagree. Go ahead.
I would say that if you want to produce the best product at the lowest price to make the most profit.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a huge problem when you're the only company out there and you are charging
yeah.
way above and beyond.
Rockefeller always reasoned, and he said this, that if I charge, because he had a huge market share, if I decided to charge 9 and 10 cents a gallon, he said, at first I might make a lot, but I will encourage other companies to get in. And not only will they get in, but they'll make long-term contracts because people say, whoa, the price is unstable. And somebody will come in and promise to offer 8.5 cents a gallon for 10 years to some firm, and I'll get locked out for 10 years.
You produce more competition.
Yeah.
My second question was...
Right. Right.
You know, why is the government, like, right now, doing something
subsidies
to the airline industry? Like,
right.
What you just brought up. Like,
you are asking a good question. And part of this, we are having a seminar here at the Foundation for Economic Education. A lot of this is economic education. There are still a lot of people who say, oh, here's something that needs doing. Let's have the government have a program to get it done.
Well, I mean, because if the government got out of the picture, don't you think things would improve?
Yes.
The
yes.
Get out of the picture, and then compete, and let the entrepreneurs come in and
yes. figure out. Right. It is. And the direction, and your generation here is important here because the direction, in some ways, is not going well because we have people saying, hey, we need health care, more government and that. Now, it's simply to say, history provides numerous illustrations in industry after industry over a long period of time. The examples that I see again and again and again are when it's turned over to private enterprise, it goes about like Vanderbilt and Hill and Rockefeller, and when it's government involved, it goes about like Collins and the Union Pacific. The more we can promote these ideas, whether for those of you who are students to discuss them with your teachers, for some of you to get into this, these ideas and write them yourselves. Many people got started at Fee. I was reading, when I was a kid practically, reading the Freeman. And it helped me because I knew someone was out there producing articles that made sense out of markets. The better we do with economic education, the more we will overcome this. We have some hurdles.
Why does the government, like, in the instance of the airline industry, though, like, I guess, what are they trying to accomplish? They're trying to look good in the eyes of the American public by
Yeah, part of it is the airlines themselves cause. See, it's like Collins. You say, how did the government just decide to do this? Collins weaved this beautiful scene of good things will happen if the subsidy comes my way. And the airlines, many of them are doing the same thing. Oh, we have to check all these people going through the airports. We need a subsidy. Give us a subsidy.
There are countries that have government-owned airlines. Well.
Yeah, some have government-owned airlines, right.
And they don't do very well.
And they don't do very well. So, right, so you have to, there's always somebody out there who wants a subsidy, right? And so we have, the more we're educated, the more we can say, wait a minute, that isn't a very good idea. Those things don't work.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, that puts us more in debt than we can afford to be.
Exactly.
In debt as a country anyway.
Exactly. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Quick comment. You're doing a huge service in telling a story because when people like us leave here,
okay.
10 years from now, we'll still remember the story.
Well, that's great.
Well,
thank you. That's good. Yeah, a story kind of sticks. Sometimes I think you're right. It tends to stick in your mind, and you have this image of Collins out there and Vanderbilt and what's happening. Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad that helped you. Thank you. Yeah. Let's call it an evening.